his knuckles will be white from inner tension, and his pants will be crusted with semen from constantly jacking off when he can't find a rape victim. He will stagger and babble when questioned. He will not respect your badge. The dope fiend fears nothing. He will attack for no reason with every weapon at his command, including yours. Beware. Any officer apprehending a suspected marijuana addict should use all necessary force immediately. One stitch in time on him will usually save nine on you. Good luck, the chief.
Indeed. Luck is always important, especially in Las Vegas, and ours was getting worse. It was clear at a glance that this drug conference was not what we'd planned on. It was far too open, too mixed. About a third of the crowd looked like they'd just stopped by for the show en route to a Frazier Ali rematch at the Vegas Convention Center across town, or maybe a benefit bout for old smack dealers between Liston and Marshall Key. The room fairly bristled with beards, mustaches, and super mod dress. The DA's conference had obviously drawn a goodly contingent of undercover narcs and other Twilight types. An assistant DA from Chicago wore a light tan sleeveless knit suit. His lady was the star of the Dunes Casino. She flashed through the place like Grace Slick at a Finch College class reunion. They were a classic couple, stone swingers. Just because you're a cop these days doesn't mean you can't be with it. And this conference attracted some real peacocks. But my own costume, $40 FBI wingtips and a Pat Boone Madras sports coat, was just about right for the mass median. Because for every urban hipster, there were about 20 crude-looking rednecks who could have passed for assistant football coaches at Mississippi State. These were the people who made my attorney nervous. Like most Californians, he was shocked to actually see these people from the outback. Here was the cop cream from Middle America. And Jesus, they looked and talked like a gang of drunken pig farmers. I tried to console him. They're actually nice people, I said, once you get to know them. He smiled. Know them? Are you kidding? Man, I know these people in my goddamn blood. Don't mention that word around here, I said. You'll get them excited. He nodded. You're right. I saw these bastards in Easy Rider, but I didn't believe they were real. Not like this. Not hundreds of them. My attorney was wearing a double-breasted blue pinstripe suit, a far more stylish outfit than my own, but it made him exceedingly nervous. Because to be stylishly dressed in this crowd meant that you were probably an undercover cop, and my attorney makes his living with people who are very sensitive in that area. This is a fucking nightmare, he kept muttering. Here I am infiltrating a goddamn pig conference. But sure as hell, there's some dope-dealing bomb freak in this town who's gonna recognize me and put the word out that I'm out here partying with 1,000 cops. We all wore name tags. They came with a $100 registration fee. Mine said I was a private investigator from L.A., which was true in a sense. And my attorney's name tag identified him as an expert in criminal drug analysis, which was also true, in a sense. But nobody seemed to care who was what or why. Security was too loose for that kind of gritty paranoia. But we were also a bit tense because we'd given the registrar a bad check for our dual registration fee. It was a check from one of my attorney's pimp drug underworld clients that he assumed from long experience was absolutely worthless. Seven. Motto on invitations to National DA's Convention in Vegas, April 25 through 29, 1971. If you don't know, come to learn. If you know, come to teach. The first session, the opening remarks, lasted most of the afternoon. We sat patiently through the first 2 hours, although it was clear from the start that we weren't going to learn anything, and it was equally clear that we'd be crazy to try any teaching. It was easy enough to sit there with a head full of mescaline and listen to hour after hour of irrelevant gibberish. There was certainly no risk involved. These poor bastards didn't know mescaline from macaroni. I suspect we could have done the whole thing on acid, except for some of the people. There were faces and bodies in that group who would have been absolutely unendurable on acid. The sight of a 344-pound police chief from Waco, Texas, necking openly with his 290-pound wife, or whatever woman he had with him, when the lights were turned off for a dope film, was just barely tolerable on mescaline, which is mainly a sensual surface drug that exaggerates reality instead of altering it. But with a head full of acid, the sight of two fantastically obese human beings far gone in a public grope while 1,000 cops all around them watched a movie about the dangers of marijuana would not be emotionally acceptable. The brain would reject it. The medulla would attempt to close itself off from the signals it was getting from the frontal lobes. And the middle brain, meanwhile, would be trying desperately to put a different interpretation on the scene before passing it back to the medulla and the risk of physical action. Acid is a relatively complex drug in its effects, while mescaline is pretty simple and straightforward. But in a scene like this, the difference was academic. There was simply no call at this conference for anything but a massive consumption of downers, reds, grass, and booze, because the whole program had apparently been set up by people who had been in a second-all stupor since 1964. Here were more than 1,000 top-level cops telling each other, "We must come to terms with the drug culture." But they had no idea where to start. They couldn't even find the goddamn thing. There were rumors in the hallways that maybe the mafia was behind it, or perhaps the Beatles. At one point, somebody in the audience asked Bloomquist if he thought Margaret Mead's strange behavior of late might possibly be explained by a private marijuana addiction. "I really don't know," Bloomquist replied. "But at her age, if she did smoke grass, she'd have one hell of a trip." The audience roared with laughter at this remark. My attorney leaned over to whisper that he was leaving. "I'll be down in the casino," he said. "I know a hell of a lot better ways to waste my time than listening to this bullshit." He stood up, knocking his ashtray off the arm of his chair, and plunged down the aisle toward the door. The seats were not arranged for random movement. People tried to make a path for him, but there was no room to move. "Watch yourself," somebody shouted as he bowled over them. "Fuck you," he snarled. "Down in front," somebody else yelled. By now he was almost to the door. "I have to get out," he shouted. "I don't belong here." "Good riddance," said a voice. He paused, looking around, but he seemed to think better of it and kept moving. By the time he got to the exit, the whole rear of the room was in turmoil. Even Bloomquist, far up front on the stage, seemed aware of a distant trouble. He stopped talking and peered nervously in the direction of the noise. Probably he thought a brawl had erupted, maybe a racial conflict of some kind, something that couldn't be helped. I stood up and plunged toward the door. It seemed like as good a time as any to flee. "Pardon me, I feel sick," I said to the first leg I stepped on. It jerked back, and I said it again. "Sorry, I'm about to be sick." "Sorry, sick. Beg pardon, yes, feeling sick." This time, a path opened very nicely. Not a word of protest. Hands actually helped me along. They feared I was about to vomit, and nobody wanted it. At least not on them. I made it to the door in about 45 seconds. My attorney was downstairs at the bar, talking to a sporty-looking cop about 40 whose plastic name tag said he was the DA from some place in Georgia. "I'm a whiskey man myself," he was saying. "We don't have much problem with drugs down where I come from." You will, said my attorney. One of these nights you'll wake up and find a junkie tearing your bedroom apart. No, said the Georgia man. Not down in my parts. I joined them and ordered a tall glass of rum with ice. You're another one of these California boys, he said. Your friend here has been telling me about dope fiends. They're everywhere, I said. Nobody's safe. And sure as hell not in the South. They like the warm weather. They work in pairs, said my attorney. Sometimes in gangs. They'll climb right into your bedroom and sit on your chest with big bowie knives. He nodded solemnly. They might even sit on your wife's chest, put the blade right down on her throat. Jesus God Almighty, said the Southerner. What the hell's going on in this country? You'd never believe it, said my attorney. In L.A., it's out of control. First it was drugs, now it's witchcraft. Witchcraft? Shit, you can't mean it. Read the newspapers, I said. Man, you don't know trouble until you have to face down a bunch of these addicts gone crazy for human sacrifice. Nah, he said. That's science fiction stuff. Not where we operate, said my attorney. Hell, in Malibu alone, these goddamn Satan worshippers kill 6 or 8 people every day. He paused to sip his drink. And all they want is the blood, he continued. They'll take people right off the street if they have to. He nodded. Hell yes, just the other day we had a case where they grabbed a girl right out of a McDonald's hamburger stand. She was a waitress, about 16 years old, with a lot of people watching, too. What happened? Said our friend. What did they do to her? He seemed very agitated by what he was hearing. Do? Said my attorney. Jesus Christ, man, they chopped her goddamn head off right there in the parking lot. Then they cut all kinds of holes in her and sucked out the blood. God almighty, the Georgia man exclaimed. And nobody did anything? What could they do? I said. The guy that took the head was about 6'7" and maybe 300 pounds. He was packing 2 Lugers, and the others had M16s. They were all veterans. The big guy used to be a major in the Marines, said my attorney. We know where he lives, but we can't get near the house. No, our friend shouted. Not a major. He wanted the pineal gland, I said. That's how he got so big. When he quit the Marines, he was just a little guy. Oh, my God, said our friend. That's horrible. It happens every day, said my attorney. Usually it's whole families, during the night. Most of them don't even wake up until they feel their heads going, and then, of course, it's too late. The bartender had stopped to listen. I'd been watching him. His expression was not calm. 3 more rums, I said, with plenty of ice and maybe a handful of lime chunks. He nodded, but I could see that his mind was not on his work. He was staring at our name tags. Are you guys with that police convention upstairs? He said finally. We sure are, my friend, said the Georgia man with a big smile. The bartender shook his head sadly. I thought so, he said. I never heard that kind of talk at this bar before. Jesus Christ! How do you guys stand that kind of work? My attorney smiled at him. We like it, he said. It's groovy. The bartender drew back. His face was a mask of repugnance. What's wrong with you? I said. Hell, somebody has to do it. He stared at me for a moment, then turned away. Hurry up with those drinks, said my attorney. We're thirsty. He laughed and rolled his eyes as the bartender glanced back at him. Only 2 rums, he said. Make mine a Bloody Mary. The bartender seemed to stiffen, but our Georgia friend didn't notice. His mind was somewhere else. Hell, I really hate to hear this, he said quietly, because everything that happens in California seems to get down our way sooner or later. Mostly Atlanta, but I guess that was back when the goddamn bastards were peaceful. It used to be that all we had to do was keep them under surveillance. They didn't roam around much. He shrugged. But now, Jesus, nobody's safe. They could turn up anywhere.
You're right, said my attorney. We learned that in California.
You remember where Manson turned up, don't you? Right out in the middle of Death Valley. He had a whole army of sex fiends out there. We only got our hands on a few. Most of the crew got away, just ran off across the sand dunes like big lizards, and every one of them stark naked except for the weapons.
They'll turn up somewhere pretty soon, I said, and let's hope we'll be ready for them.
The Georgia man whacked his fist on the bar.
But we can't just lock ourselves in the house and be prisoners, he exclaimed. We don't even know who these people are. How do you recognize them?
You can't, my attorney replied. The only way to do it is to take the bull by the horns, go to the mat with this scum.
What do you mean by that? He asked.
You know what I mean, said my attorney. We've done it before, and we can damn well do it again.
Cut their goddamn heads off, I said. Every one of them. That's what we're doing in California.
What?
Sure, said my attorney. It's all on the QT, but everybody who matters is with us all the way down the line.
God, I had no idea it was that bad out there, said our friend.
We keep it quiet, I said. It's not the kind of thing you'd want to talk about upstairs, for instance, not with the press around.
Our man agreed.
Hell no, he said. We'd never hear the goddamn end of it.
Dobermans don't talk, I said.
What?
Sometimes it's easier to just rip out the back straps, said my attorney. They'll fight like hell if you try to take the head without dogs.
God almighty!
We left him at the bar, swirling the ice in his drink and not smiling. He was worried about whether or not to tell his wife about it.
She'd never understand, he muttered. You know how women are.
I nodded. My attorney was already gone, scurrying through a maze of slot machines toward the front door. I said goodbye to our friend, warning him not to say anything about what we'd told him.
Eight. Backdoor beauty, and finally a bit of serious drag racing on the strip. Sometime around midnight, my attorney wanted coffee. He had been vomiting fairly regularly as we drove around the strip, and the right flank of the Whale was badly streaked. We were idling at a stoplight in front of the Silver Slipper beside a big blue Ford with Oklahoma plates. Two hoggish-looking couples in the car, probably cops from Muskogee, using the drug conference to give their wives a look at Vegas. They looked like they'd just beaten Caesar's Palace for about $33 at the blackjack tables, and now they were headed for the circus to whoop it up. But suddenly they found themselves next to a white Cadillac convertible all covered with vomit and a 300-pound Samoan in a yellow fishnet T-shirt yelling at them.
Hey there, you folks want to buy some heroin?
No reply. No sign of recognition. They've been warned about this kind of crap. Just ignore it.
Hey, honkies, my attorney screamed. God damn it, I'm serious. I want to sell you some pure fucking smack.
He was leaning out of the car, very close to them. But still nobody answered. I glanced over very briefly and saw four middle American faces frozen with shock, staring straight ahead. We were in the middle lane. A quick left turn would be illegal. We would have to go straight ahead when the light changed, then escape at the next corner. I waited, tapping the accelerator nervously. My attorney was losing control.
Cheap heroin, he was shouting. This is the real stuff. You won't get hooked. God damn it, I know what I have here.
He whacked on the side of the car as if to get their attention, but they wanted no part of us.
You folks never talked to a vet before, said my attorney. I just got back from Vietnam. This is skag, folks, pure skag.
Suddenly the light changed, and the Ford bolted off like a rocket. I stomped on the accelerator and stayed right next to them for about 200 yards, watching for cops in the mirror, while my attorney kept screaming at them. Shoot! Fuck! Skag! Blood! Heroin! Rape! Cheap! Communist! Jab it right into your fucking eyeballs! We were approaching the circus at high speed, and the Oklahoma car was veering left, trying to muscle into the turn lane. I stomped the whale into passing gear, and we ran fender to fender for a moment. He wasn't up to hitting me. There was horror in his eyes. The man in the back seat lost control of himself, lunging across his wife and snarling wildly. You dirty bastards! Pull over and I'll kill you! God damn you, you bastards! He seemed ready to leap out the window and into our car, crazy with rage. Luckily, the Ford was a two-door. He couldn't get out. We were coming up to the next stoplight, and the Ford was still trying to move left. We were both running full bore. I glanced over my shoulder and saw that we'd left the other traffic far behind. There was a big opening to the right. So I mashed on the brake, hurling my attorney against the dashboard, and in the instant the Ford surged ahead, I cut across his tail and zoomed into a side street, a sharp right turn across three lanes of traffic. But it worked. We left the Ford stalled in the middle of the intersection, hung in the middle of a screeching left turn. With a little luck, he'd be arrested for reckless driving. My attorney was laughing as we careened in low gear with the lights out through a dusty tangle of back streets behind the Desert Inn. Jesus Christ, he said. Those Okies were getting excited. That guy in the back seat was trying to bite me. Shit, he was frothing at the mouth. He nodded solemnly. I should have maced the fucker. A criminal psychotic. Total breakdown. You never know when they're likely to explode. I swung the whale into a turn that seemed to lead out of the maze, but instead of skidding, the bastard almost rolled. Holy shit! My attorney screamed. Turn on the fucking lights! He was clinging to the top of the windshield, and suddenly he was doing the big spit again, leaning over the side. I refused to slow down until I was sure nobody was following us, especially that Oklahoma Ford. Those people were definitely dangerous, at least until they calmed down. Would they report that terrible quick encounter to the police? Probably not. It had happened too fast with no witnesses, and the odds are pretty good that nobody would believe them anyway. The idea that two heroin pushers in a white Cadillac convertible would be dragging up and down the strip, abusing total strangers at stoplights, was prima facie absurd. Not even Sonny Liston ever got that far out of control. We made another turn and almost rolled again. The Coupe de Ville is not your ideal machine for high-speed cornering in residential neighborhoods. The handling is very mushy, unlike the Red Shark, which had responded very nicely to situations requiring the quick four-wheel drift. But the whale, instead of cutting loose at the critical moment, had a tendency to dig in, which accounted for that sickening, here-we-go sensation. At first I thought it was only because the tires were soft, so I took it into the Texaco station next to the Flamingo and had the tires pumped up to 50 pounds each, which alarmed the attendant until I explained that these were experimental tires. But 50 pounds each didn't help the cornering, so I went back a few hours later and told him I wanted to try 75. He shook his head nervously. Not me, he said, handing me the ear hose. Here, they're your tires, you do it. What's wrong? I asked. You think they can't take 75? He nodded, moving away, as I stooped to deal with the left front. You're damn right, he said. Those tires want 28 in the front, 32 in the rear. Hell, 50's dangerous, but 75 is crazy. They'll explode. I shook my head and kept filling the left front. I told you, I said. Sandoz Laboratories designed these tires. They're special. I could load them up to 100. God almighty, he groaned. Don't do that here.
Not today, I replied. I want to see how they corner with 75. He chuckled. You won't even get to the corner, mister.
We'll see, I said, moving around to the rear with the air hose. In truth, I was nervous. The two front ones were tighter than snare drums. They felt like teak wood when I tapped on them with the rod. But what the hell, I thought. If they explode, so what? It's not often that a man gets a chance to run terminal experiments on a virgin Cadillac and four brand new $80 tires. For all I knew, the thing might start cornering like a Lotus Elan. If not, all I had to do was call the VIP agency and have another one delivered. Maybe threaten them with a lawsuit because all four tires had exploded on me while driving in heavy traffic. Demand an Eldorado next time with four Michelin X's and put it all on the card. Charge it to the St. Louis Browns. As it turned out, the Whale behaved very nicely with the altered tire pressures. The ride was a trifle rough. I could feel every pebble on the highway, like being on roller skates in a gravel pit. But the thing began cornering in a very stylish manner, very much like driving a motorcycle at top speed in a hard rain. One slip, and zang, over the high side, cartwheeling across the landscape with your head in your hands. About 30 minutes after our brush with the Okies, we pulled into an all-night diner on the Tonopah Highway, on the outskirts of a mean skag ghetto called North Las Vegas, which is actually outside the city limits of Vegas proper. North Vegas is where you go when you fucked up once too often on the Strip, and when you're not even welcome in the cut-rate downtown places around Casino Center. This is Nevada's answer to East St. Louis, a slum in a graveyard, last stop before permanent exile to Ely or Winnemucca. North Vegas is where you go if you're a hooker turning 40 and the syndicate men on the Strip decide you're no longer much good for business out there with the high rollers, or if you're a pimp with bad credit at the Sands, or what they still call in Vegas a hophead. This can mean almost anything from a mean drunk to a junkie, but in terms of commercial acceptability, it means you're finished in all the right places. The big hotels and casinos pay a lot of muscle to make sure the high rollers don't have even momentary hassles with undesirables. Security in a place like Caesar's Palace is super tense and strict. Probably a third of the people on the floor at any given time are either shills or watchdogs. Public drunks and known pickpockets are dealt with instantly, hustled out to the parking lot by Secret Service-type thugs, and given a quick impersonal lecture about the cost of dental work and the difficulties of trying to make a living with two broken arms. The high side of Vegas is probably the most closed society west of Sicily, and it makes no difference, in terms of the day-to-day lifestyle of the place, whether the man at the top is Lucky Luciano or Howard Hughes. In an economy where Tom Jones can make $75,000 a week for two shows a night at Caesar's, the palace guard is indispensable, and they don't care who signs their paychecks. A gold mine like Vegas breeds its own army, like any other gold mine. Hired muscle tends to accumulate in fast layers around money power poles, and big money in Vegas is synonymous with the power to protect it. So once you get blacklisted on the Strip for any reason at all, you either get out of town or retire to nurse your act along on the cheap in the shoddy limbo of North Vegas, out there with the gunsels, the hustlers, the drug cripples, and all the other losers. North Vegas, for instance, is where you go if you need to score smack before midnight with no references. But if you're looking for cocaine, and you're ready up front with some bills and the proper code words, you want to stay on the Strip and get next to a well-connected hooker, which will take at least one bill for starters. And so much for all that. We didn't fit the mold. There is no formula for finding yourself in Vegas with a white Cadillac full of drugs and nothing to mix with properly. The Fillmore style never quite caught on here. People like Sinatra and Dean Martin are still considered far out in Vegas. The underground newspaper here, the Las Vegas Free Press, is a cautious echo of the People's World, or maybe the National Guardian. A week in Vegas is like stumbling into a time warp, a regression to the late 50s, which is wholly understandable when you see the people who come here, the big spenders from places like Denver and Dallas, along with National Elks Club conventions, no niggers allowed, and the all-West volunteer sheep herders rally. These are people who go absolutely crazy at the sight of an old hooker stripping down to her pasties and prancing out on the runway to the big beat sound of a dozen 50-year-old junkies kicking out the jams on September Song. It was sometime around 3 when we pulled into the parking lot of the North Vegas Diner. I was looking for a copy of the Los Angeles Times for news of the outside world, but a quick glance at the newspaper racks made a bad joke of that notion. They don't need the Times in North Vegas. No news is good news.
"Fuck newspapers," said my attorney. "What we need right now is coffee."
I agreed, but I stole a copy of the Vegas Sun anyway. It was yesterday's edition, but I didn't care. The idea of entering a coffee shop without a newspaper in my hands made me nervous. There was always the sports section. Get wired on the baseball scores and pro football rumors. Bart Starr beaten by thugs in Chicago Tavern. Packers seek trade. Namath quits Jets to be governor of Alabama. And a speculative piece on page 46 about a rookie sensation named Harrison Fire out of Grambling. Runs the 109 flat. 344 pounds and still growing.
"This man Fire has definite promise," says the coach. "Yesterday before practice he destroyed a Greyhound bus with his bare hands, and last night he killed a subway. He's a natural for color TV. I'm not one to play favorites, but it looks like we'll have to make room for him."
Indeed. There is always room on TV for a man who can beat people to jelly in 9 flat. But not many of these were gathered on this night in the North Star Coffee Lounge. We had the place to ourselves, which proved to be fortunate because we'd eaten 2 more pellets of mescaline on the way over, and the effects were beginning to manifest. My attorney was no longer vomiting or even acting sick. He ordered coffee with the authority of a man long accustomed to quick service. The waitress had the appearance of a very old hooker who had finally found her place in life. She was definitely in charge here, and she eyed us with obvious disapproval as we settled onto our stools. I wasn't paying much attention. The North Star Coffee Lounge seemed like a fairly safe haven from our storms. There are some you go into, in this line of work, that you know will be heavy. The details don't matter. All you know for sure is that your brain starts humming with brutal vibes as you approach the front door. Something wild and evil is about to happen, and it's going to involve you. But there was nothing in the atmosphere of the North Star to put me on my guard. The waitress was passively hostile, but I was accustomed to that. She was a big woman. Not fat, but large in every way. Long, sinewy arms and a brawler's jawbone. A burned-out caricature of Jane Russell. Big head of dark hair, face slashed with lipstick, and a 48 double E chest that was probably spectacular about 20 years ago, when she might have been a mama for the Hell's Angels chapter in Purdue. But now she was strapped up in a giant, pink, elastic brassiere that showed like a bandage through the sweaty white rayon of her uniform. Probably she was married to somebody, but I didn't feel like speculating. All I wanted from her tonight was a cup of black coffee and a 29-cent hamburger with pickles and onions. No hassles, no talk, just a place to rest and regroup. I wasn't even hungry. My attorney had no newspaper or anything else to compel his attention, so he focused, out of boredom, on the waitress. She was taking our orders like a robot when he punched through her crust with a demand for 2 glasses of ice water, with ice. My attorney drank his in one long gulp, then asked for another. I noticed that the waitress seemed tense. Fuck it, I thought. I was reading the funnies. About 10 minutes later, when she brought the hamburgers, I saw my attorney hand her a napkin with something printed on it. He did it very casually, with no expression at all on his face. But I knew from the vibes that our peace was about to be shattered. "What was that?" I asked him. He shrugged, smiling vaguely at the waitress who was standing about 10 feet away at the end of the counter, keeping her back to us while she pondered the napkin. Finally, she turned and stared. Then she stepped resolutely forward and tossed the napkin at my attorney. "What is this?" she snapped.
"A napkin," said my attorney.
There was a moment of nasty silence, then she began screaming, "Don't give me that bullshit! I know what it means, you goddamn fat pimp bastard!" My attorney picked up the napkin, looked at what he'd written, then dropped it back on the counter.
"That's the name of a horse I used to own," he said calmly. "What's wrong with you?"
"You son of a bitch," she screamed. "I take a lot of shit in this place, but I sure as hell don't have to take it off a spick pimp."
"Jesus," I thought, "what's happening?" I was watching the woman's hands, hoping she wouldn't pick up anything sharp or heavy. I picked up the napkin and read what the bastard had printed on it in careful red letters. "Backdoor beauty?" The question mark was emphasized. The woman was screaming again. "Pay your bill and get the hell out! You want me to call the cops?"
I reached for my wallet, but my attorney was already on his feet, never taking his eyes off the woman. Then he reached under his shirt, not into his pocket, coming up suddenly with the Gerber Mini Magnum, a nasty silver blade which the waitress seemed to understand instantly. She froze, her eyes fixed wildly on the blade. My attorney, still watching her, moved about 6 feet down the aisle and lifted the receiver off the hook of the payphone. He sliced it off and brought the receiver back to his stool and sat down. The waitress didn't move. I was stupid with shock, not knowing whether to run or start laughing.
"How much is that lemon meringue pie?" my attorney asked. His voice was casual, as if he had just wandered into the place and was debating what to order.
35 cents, the woman blurted. Her eyes were turgid with fear, but her brain was apparently functioning on some basic motor survival level. My attorney laughed.
"I mean the whole pie," he said.
She moaned. My attorney put a bill on the counter.
"Let's say it's $5, he said. "Okay?"
She nodded, still frozen, watching my attorney as he walked around the counter and got the pie out of the display case. I prepared to leave. The waitress was clearly in shock. The sight of the blade, jerked out in the heat of an argument, had apparently triggered bad memories. The glazed look in her eyes said her throat had been cut. She was still in the grip of paralysis when we left. Nine. Breakdown on Paradise Boulevard. Editor's note. At this point in the chronology, Dr. Duke appears to have broken down completely. The original manuscript is so splintered that we were forced to seek out the original tape recording and transcribe it verbatim. We made no attempt to edit this section, and Dr. Duke refused even to read it. There was no way to reach him. The only address/contact we had during this period was a mobile phone unit somewhere on Highway 61, and all efforts to reach Duke at that number proved futile. In the interests of journalistic purity, we are publishing the following section just as it came off the tape, one of many that Dr. Duke submitted for purposes of verification, along with his manuscript. According to the tape, this section follows an episode involving Duke, his attorney, and a waitress at an all-night diner in North Vegas. The rationale for the following transaction appears to be based on a feeling shared by both Duke and his attorney that the American dream would have to be sought out somewhere far beyond the dreary confines of the District Attorney's Conference on Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. The transcription begins somewhere on the northeast outskirts of Las Vegas, zooming along Paradise Road in the White Whale.
Boulder City is to the right. Is that a town?
Yeah.
Let's go to Boulder City.
All right, let's get some coffee somewhere.
Right up here, Terry's Taco Stand, USA. I could go for a taco. 5 for a buck.
Sounds horrible. I'd rather go somewhere where there's 1 for 50 cents.
No, this might be the last chance we get for tacos.
I need some coffee.
I want tacos.
5 for a buck, that's like 5 hamburgers for a buck.
No, don't judge a taco by its price.
You think you might make a deal?
I might. There's a hamburger for 29 cents. Tacos are 29 cents. It's just a cheap place, that's all.
Go bargain with them.
Editor's note, only garbled sounds here.
Hello?
May I help you?
Yeah, you have tacos here? Are they Mexican tacos or just regular tacos? I mean, do you have chili in them and things like that?
We have cheese and lettuce, and we have sauce, you know, put on them.
I mean, do you guarantee that they are authentic Mexican tacos?
I don't know. Hey, Lou, do we have authentic Mexican tacos?
Woman's voice from the kitchen.
What?
Authentic Mexican tacos.
We have tacos. I don't know how Mexican they are.
Yeah, well, I just want to make sure I get what I'm paying for, because they're 5 for a dollar. I'll take 5 of them.
Taco burger. What's that?
Editor's note. Sounds of diesel engine trucks.
That's a hamburger with a taco in the middle.
Instead of a shell.
A taco on a bun.
I bet you your tacos are just hamburgers with a shell instead of a bun.
I don't know.
You just started working here?
Today.
I thought so. I've never seen you here before. You go to school around here?
No, I don't go to school.
Oh, why not? Are you sick?
Never mind that. We came here for tacos.
Editor's note. Here there was a pause. As your attorney, I advise you to get the chili burger. It's a hamburger with chili on it.
That's too heavy for me.
Then I advise you to get a taco burger. Try that one.
The taco has meat in it. I'll try that one. And some coffee now. Right now. So I can drink it while I'm waiting.
That's all you want? One taco burger?
Well, I'll try it. I might want 2.
Are your eyes blue or green?
Pardon?
Blue or green?
They change.
Like a lizard?
Like a cat.
Oh, the lizard changes the color of his skin.
Want anything to drink?
Beer. And I have beer in the car, tons of it. The whole back seat's full of it. I don't like mixing coconuts up with beer and hamburgers. Well, let's smash the bastards right in the middle of the highway. Is Boulder City somewhere around here?
Boulder City? Do you want sugar?
Yeah.
We're in Boulder City, huh? Or very close to it.
I don't know.
There it is. That sign says Boulder City, okay? Aren't you from Nevada?
No. We've never been here before, just traveling through.
You just go straight up this road here.
Any action up there in Boulder City?
Don't ask me. I don't...
Any gambling there?
I don't know. It's just a little town.
Where is the casino?
I don't know.
Wait a minute. Where are you from?
New York.
And you've just been here a day?
No. I've been here for a while.
Where do you go around here? Say you wanted to go swimming or something like that.
In my backyard.
What's the address?
Go to the... The pool's not open yet.
Let me explain it to you. Let me run it down just briefly if I can. We're looking for the American Dream. And we were told it was somewhere in this area. Well, we're here looking for it because they sent us out here all the way from San Francisco to look for it. That's why they gave us this white Cadillac. They figured that we could catch up with it in that.
Hey, Lou, you know where the American Dream is?
She's asking the cook if she knows where the American Dream is.
5 tacos, 1 taco burger. Do you know where the American Dream is? What's that? What is it?
Well, we don't know. We were sent out here from San Francisco to look for the American Dream by a magazine to cover it.
Oh, you mean a place?
A place called the American Dream.
Is that the old psychiatrist club? I think so.
The old psychiatrist club?
Old psychiatrist club. It's on Paradise. Are you guys serious?
Oh, no, honest. Look at that car. I mean, do I look like I'd own a car like that?
Could that be the old psychiatrist club? It was a discotheque place.
Maybe that's it.
It's on Paradise and what? Ross Allen had the old psychiatrist club. Is he the owner now?
I don't know. All we were told was go till you find the American Dream. Take this white Cadillac and go find the American Dream. It's somewhere in the Las Vegas area.
That has to be the old...
And it's a silly story to do, but you know, that's what we get paid for.
Are you taking pictures of it, or...
No pictures.
Or did somebody just send you on a goose chase?
It's sort of a wild goose chase, more or less, but personally, we're dead serious.
That has to be the old psychiatrist club, but the only people who hang out there is a bunch of pushers, peddlers, uppers and downers, and all that stuff.
Maybe that's it. Is it a nighttime place, or is it an all-day?
Oh, honey, this never stops. But it's not a casino.
What kind of place is it?
It's on Paradise. The Old Psychiatrist Club on Paradise.
Is that what it's called? The Old Psychiatrist Club?
No. That is what it used to be. But someone bought it. But I didn't hear about it as the American Dream. It was something like associated with, it's a mental joint where all the dopers hang out.
A mental joint? You mean like a mental hospital?
No, honey, where all the dope peddlers and all the pushers, everybody hangs out. It's a place where all the kids are potted when they go in and everything. But it's not called what you said, the American Dream.
Do you have any idea what it might be called, or more or less where it might be located?
Right off of Paradise and Eastern. But Paradise and Eastern are parallel. Yeah, but I know I come off Eastern, and then I go to Paradise. Yeah, I know it. But then that would make it off Paradise around the Flamingo, straight up here. I think somebody's handed you a...
We're staying at the Flamingo. I think this place you're talking about and the way you're describing it, I think that maybe that's it.
It's not a tourist joint.
Well, that's why they sent me. He's the writer. I'm the bodyguard. 'Cause I figure it will be...
These guys are nuts. These kids are nuts.
That's okay.
Yeah, they got new laws.
24-hour-a-day violence? Is that what we're saying?
Exactly. Now, here's the Flamingo. Oh, I can't show you this. I can tell you better my way. Right up here at the first gas station is Tropicana. Take a right.
Tropicana to the right.
The first gas station is Tropicana. Take a right on Tropicana and take this way. Right on Tropicana, right on Paradise, you'll see a big black building. It's all painted black and real weird looking.
Right on Tropicana, right on Paradise, black building.
And there's a sign on the side of the building that says Psychiatrist Club. But they're completely remodeling it and everything.
All right, that's close enough.
If there's anything I can do for you, honey, I don't know if that's even it or not, but it sounds like it is. I think you boys are on the right track.
Right. That's the best lead we've had for 2 days. We've been asking people all around.
I could make a couple calls and sure as hell find out.
Could you?
Sure, I'll call Alan and ask him.
Gee, I'd appreciate that if you could.
When you go down to Tropicana, it's not the first gas station, the second. There's a big sign right down the street here. It says, Tropicana Avenue, make a right. And when you get to Paradise, make another right.
Okay, big black building, right on Paradise. 24-hour-a-day violence, drugs.
See, here's Tropicana, and this is Boulder Highway that goes clear down like that.
Well, that's pretty far into town, then.
Well, here's Paradise split up somewhere around there. There's Paradise. Yeah, we're down in here. See, this is Boulder Highway and Tropicana. Well, that's not it. That bartender in there is a pothead, too.
Yeah, well, it's a lead.
You're gonna be glad you stopped here, boys.
Only if we find it. Only if we write the article and get it in.
Well, why don't you come inside and sit down?
We're trying to get as much sun as we can. She's going to make a phone call to find out where it is. Oh, okay. Well, let's go inside. Editor's note. Tape cassettes for the next sequence were impossible to transcribe due to some viscous liquid encrusted behind the heads. There is a certain consistency in the garbled sounds, however, indicating that almost 2 hours later, Dr. Duke and his attorney finally located what was left of the Old Psychiatrists Club, a huge slab of cracked, scorched concrete in a vacant lot full of tall weeds. The owner of a gas station across the road said the place had burned down about 3 years ago.
This ends Disc 4. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Disc 5.
10.
Heavy duty at the airport. Ugly Peruvian flashback. No, it's too late. Don't try it. My attorney left at dawn. We almost missed the first flight to L.A. because I couldn't find the airport. It was less than 30 minutes from the hotel. I was sure of that. So we left the Flamingo at exactly 7:30. But for some reason, we failed to make the turnoff at the stoplight in front of the Tropicana. We kept going straight ahead on the freeway, which parallels the main airport runway, but on the opposite side from the terminal, and there is no way to get across legally.
God damn it, we're lost, my attorney was shouting. What are we doing out here on this godforsaken road? The airport is right over there.
He pointed hysterically across the tundra. Don't worry, I said. I've never missed a plane yet. I smiled as the memory came back. Except once in Peru, I added. I was already checked out of the country through customs, but I went back to the bar to chat with this Bolivian cocaine dealer. And all of a sudden, I heard those big 707 engines starting up, so I ran out to the runway and tried to get aboard. But the door was right behind the engines, and they'd already rolled the ladder away. Shit, those afterburners would have fried me like bacon. But I was completely out of my head. I was desperate to get aboard. The airport cops saw me coming, and they gathered into a knot at the gate. I was running like a bastard straight at them. The guy with me was screaming, "No, it's too late, don't try it." I saw the cops waiting for me, so I slowed down like maybe I'd change my mind.
But when I saw them relax, I did a quick change of pace and tried to run right over the bastards. I laughed. Jesus, it was like running full bore into a closet full of Gila monsters. The fuckers almost killed me. All I remember is seeing 5 or 6 billy clubs coming down on me at the same time and a lot of voices screaming, "No, no, it's suicide! Stop the crazy gringo!" I woke up about 2 hours later in a bar in downtown Lima. They'd stretched me out in one of those half-moon leather booths. My luggage was all stacked beside me. Nobody had opened it. So I went back to sleep and caught the first flight out the next morning. My attorney was only half listening. "Look," he said, "I'd really like to hear more about your adventures in Peru, but not now. Right now, all I care about is getting across that goddamn runway." We were flashing along at good speed. I was looking for an opening, some kind of access road, some lane across the runway to the terminal. We were 5 miles past the last stoplight, and there wasn't enough time to turn around and go back to it. There was only one way to make it on time. I hit the brakes and eased the whale down into the grassy moat between the two freeway lanes. The ditch was too deep for a head-on run, so I took it at an angle. The whale almost rolled, but I kept the wheels churning, and we careened up the opposite bank and into the oncoming lane. Fortunately, it was empty. We came out of the moat with the nose of the car up in the air like a hydroplane, then bounced on the freeway and kept right on going into the cactus field on the other side. I recall running over a fence of some kind and dragging it a few hundred yards. But by the time we got to the runway, we were fully under control, screaming along about 60 miles an hour in low gear, and it looked like a wide-open run all the way to the terminal. My only worry was the chance of getting crushed like a roach by an incoming DC-8, which we probably wouldn't see until it was right on top of us. I wondered if they could see us from the tower. Probably so, but why worry? I kept the thing floored. There was no point in turning back now. My attorney was hanging onto the dashboard with both hands. I glanced over and saw fear in his eyes. His face appeared to be gray, and I sensed he was not happy with this move. But we were going so fast across the runway, then cactus, then runway again, that I knew he understood our position. We were past the point of debating the wisdom of this move. It was already done, and our only hope was to get to the other side. I looked at my skeleton face Accutron and saw that we had 3 minutes and 15 seconds before takeoff. "Plenty of time," I said. "Get your stuff together. I'll drop you right next to the plane." I could see the big red and silver Western jetliner about 1,000 yards ahead of us. And by this time, we were skimming across smooth asphalt, past the incoming runway. "No," he shouted. "I can't get out. They'll crucify me. I'll have to take the blame." "Ridiculous," I said. "Just say you were hitchhiking to the airport and I picked you up. You never saw me before. Shit, this town is full of white Cadillac convertibles. And I plan to go through there so fast that nobody will even glimpse the goddamn license plate." We were approaching the plane. I could see passengers boarding, but so far nobody had noticed us. Approaching from this unlikely direction. "Are you ready?" I said. He groaned. "Why not? But for Christ's sake, let's do it fast." He was scanning the loading area. Then he pointed. "Over there," he said. "Drop me behind that big van. Just pull in behind it, and I'll jump out where they can't see me. Then you can make a run for it." I nodded. So far, we had all the room we needed. No sign of alarm or pursuit. I wondered if maybe this kind of thing happened all the time in Vegas. Cars full of late-arriving passengers screeching desperately across the runway, dropping off wild-eyed Samoans clutching mysterious canvas bags, who would sprint onto planes at the last possible second and then roar off into the sunrise. Maybe so, I thought. Maybe this kind of thing is standard procedure in this town.
I swung in behind the van and hit the brakes just long enough for my attorney to jump out.
"Don't take any guff from these swine," I yelled. "Remember, if you have any trouble, you can always send a telegram to the right people."
He grinned.
"Yeah, explaining my position," he said. "Some asshole wrote a poem about that once. It's probably good advice, if you have shit for brains."
He waved me off.
"Right," I said, moving out.
I'd already spotted a break in the big hurricane fence, and now, with the whale in low gear, I went for it. Nobody seemed to be chasing me. I couldn't understand it. I glanced in the mirror and saw my attorney climbing into the plane.